A quick glance at Anne Winterbotham Campbell might have led you to believe she was a well-heeled retired schoolteacher, which she was. After a closer look at, say, the agate scarab beetle circling her wrist, or a silk scarf printed with Hokusai's wave knotted around her neck, you'd likely have guessed her to be an artist, which her Winsor and Newton ink-stained fingers would have confirmed. But someone who midwifed the city of Sanibel into existence, who helped hammer out its progressive planning policies, role modeled its conservation ethic? Come to think of it, when Arthur Frommer recently declared Sanibel the number one travel destination in the world, Anne was entitled to a lot of the credit. Bad timing. Anne died a week before Frommer issued his pronouncement, though she'd likely have snorted at it anyway. As far as she was concerned, her work on the island, running its first planning commission, serving on the founding board of the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation, making sure there was decent water, housing for its workers, and none of those god-awful neon signs, had been only partially effective. Or maybe too effective, because people kept arriving in so many pale waves that after 2 decades there, she sold out and moved to 5 acres in Buckingham on the Orange River. The jungly place she named Simba's Keep, after a series of beloved boxers who shared the name in succession, quickly filled with animals. Donkeys and goats, parrots, macaws, cockatoos, a nocturnal bush baby she had carried home from Africa in her bra. He slept all day in a baseball mitt, but would emerge, blinking, when she called him for a nibble of banana. Indian runner ducks, peacocks, pheasants, geese, a fuzzy white rooster named Cantinflas she'd cradle like a baby, cats and dogs, an unending stream. The Simbas, of course, but also Tripod, a three-legged German shepherd, Lolita, who'd been tossed from a car as a pup, and others. The felines had the run of the place. Before long, George Campbell, a white-bearded, pith-helmeted naturalist, moved in too. Together, they wrote books, mounted safaris to Kenya, led excursions to the Galapagos Islands, and cheerfully lived in sin, their term, for almost 2 decades, until they finally decided to make it legal. They stood together in the red-tiled dining room, and a dear friend, who'd gotten a notary's license for the occasion, married them in front of Anne's long wooden table. It was the same table on which every Sunday she'd set out a plate of her trademark muffins into which she stirred whatever fruit was ripening on the place, carambolas, oranges, bananas. The excellence of her food was usually overshadowed by the cast of characters sharing it. Her rotating collection of artists, botanists, writers, veterinarians, and herpetologists formed a sort of subtropical Algonquin. I haven't told you about how Anne whipped breast cancer back when that was no mean feat, about the books and art that lined her walls, how she loved Aaron Copland, about the affectionate note from Bishop Tutu hanging over her sewing machine, or about the evening after I gave birth to DP when she showed up with chilled zucchini soup, sliced avocados, tabbouleh, and champagne. I didn't tell you that after laughing for years that if reading, thinking, and engaging prevented Alzheimer's, which was then a circulating theory, it was the one disease they wouldn't ever have to worry about. But it got them both. First George in 2004 when he was 85, and then Anne. She was 92. There's just so much more to this flinty, brilliant, prickly, loving woman than what little I've sketched, stories and insights, theories and jokes. Maybe someday I'll tell you,